Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, December 8th. Susan Glasser, who reports from Washington for The New Yorker, is a CNN global affairs analyst and co-author of the book, The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of Jim Baker. And Susan, as I welcome you back to the show, I'm just going to be transparent for the listeners and say a big thank you for pinch hitting at the very last minute for Senator Chris Murphy, who was scheduled for here but had to cancel at the last minute. So thank you, thank you, thank you, and welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you, Brian. I guess I'm curious to find out Chris Murphy has some fascinating new meeting to share with us.
Maybe so. You can call him up after the segment. One of the reasons we wanted Senator Murphy for today is that he's prominent on the Foreign Relations Committee, and you have deep foreign affairs reporting experience. So let's start with Russia on the brink of invading Ukraine again, and Biden and Putin's two-hour conversation about it yesterday. But my first question is, why should Americans care? Are there any U.S. interests at stake?
Well, you know, Brian, that is a good and important question. I think that, you know, first of all, President Biden, you know, has said that the whole purpose and the whole sort of organizing principle around his foreign policy is the idea that we face this sort of very dangerous moment in the world when essentially there's a contest between autocracies like Russia and China and democracies like the United States in a way that we just haven't seen in decades. And the front line in that confrontation between Russia and the West certainly is Ukraine. That's been the case for a number of years. This prospect of an invasion is serious. It's real. We're talking about 175,000 troops, not in some obscure place in the world, but literally in the heart of Europe right now. And that would, I think, mark a dangerous escalation, a new phase in, you know, kind of the unraveling of the international order that we've seen hold more or less since the end of the Cold War. So it's really a big deal. You have NATO members now right up to the border of Russia in the Baltic states. They were part of the Soviet Union. They are now part of NATO. You have Poland in a state of extreme alarm. And you have Ukraine, which has basically been kind of the punching bag stuck in between Russia and NATO for the decades since the end of the Soviet Union.
And it seems our only leverage, if the news is, if what we're going to be seeing, you know, in our news feeds, however we get our news over the next few days, is, oh my God, Russia invaded Ukraine. It seems like our only leverage to try to prevent it is economic sanctions, because no American will support a war for Ukraine, right? And Putin seems to take sanctions almost as a badge of honor. So do we have any leverage?
Well, it's an important question. Obviously, geography is not on Ukraine's side when you have a very powerful neighbor like Russia. You know, the United States, of course, is thousands of miles away. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and despite what Putin says, isn't going to become one anytime soon. That seems as unrealistic now, frankly, as it did in 2014 when Ukraine already was invaded by Russia. So what are U.S. tools in the toolkit right now? I think sanctions is one of them, and I do believe that there is the possibility to exact much more of a cost with sanctions than the U.S. has been willing to do, even after Russia took over Crimea. I've spoken with, you know, people who've really been in charge of this policy in the past who believe that you could take the sanctions fight much more directly to Putin, to his inner circle. Enormous corruption in recent years. That means that the oligarchs surrounding Putin, who really have shored up his regime, Putin himself, have incredible amounts of economic assets in the West that they could be targeted. Their ability to conduct business internationally could be targeted in a way that has not been done so far. Russia's economic interests could be targeted. There's the Nord Stream gas pipeline from Russia to Germany that is almost on the brink of being finished. that could finally be canceled. That's been a major sore point between the United States and Germany for the last three administrations, going back to the Obama administration. So that's something that could be canceled. So there's a variety of things. More lethal aid and military assistance to Ukraine. Remember, Obama did not want to send lethal weapons, but gave other kinds of military assistance to Ukrainians. Trump administration added lethal assistance, and the Biden administration has continued that. There could be much more done as far as that goes. And so there are things that can be done to signal to Russia in a much more explicit way. And Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, he came out yesterday and he said directly, the U.S. is prepared to take actions now that we did not take after 2014. That's the message that they're sending to Russia.
Is there kind of a trading places between liberals and conservatives on Russia? Like during the Cold War, you know, the conservatives were all gung-ho, stop the evil empire with its territorial expansion, among other things at that time. And liberals were like, oh, let's have detente and get along. And now you have the liberals saying we cannot have Russia invading Ukraine, and we have the conservatives. Maybe it's only because Russia helped Donald Trump. But saying, you know, let's not get beyond our skis here.
You know, I do think it reflects part of the ongoing sort of scrambling of what used to be known as the Republican Party that's taken place as a result of both Donald Trump and Trumpism. And, you know, you saw this incredible turnaround, for example, in polls of Republican voters once Donald Trump was, you know, sort of flattering Vladimir Putin and, you know, talking about the need to get along with Russia. You saw this dramatic switch in Republicans who had maintained the, more or less their kind of Cold War era hawkishness, you know, right on through the decades. And then Trump sort of signaled this abrupt change in course. And you did see him bringing along large numbers of Republican voters with him and changing their views. So there's been a kind of ideological scrambling. I think it also reflects this framing that President Biden, you know, has sought to put on it, which is this idea that we're entering a period almost akin to the 1930s in this conflict between democracies of the world and autocracies and dictatorships. People forget that, but that was a lot of the language that was used by Franklin Roosevelt and others in the 30s, was this idea of a conflict between democracies and dictatorships. And so I think that's part of why you see Democrats responding to that language when it comes to Vladimir Putin and the kind of threat that he poses, but the willingness of the American people to engage in any kind of military conflicts overseas is incredibly limited right now, and that's across the political spectrum, not Democrat or Republican.
Before we go on to China and the Olympics and Afghanistan, incredible moral dilemma for the United States and Afghanistan right now, I think, and we'll get to that. But to put a pin in what you said just a second ago, Biden also has this sort of summit of democracies coming up this week. It hasn't gotten a lot of press yet. Maybe it will when it takes place. I know there are some questions being raised because of some of the countries that are included that aren't such great models of democracy. But I think what you just pointed at is one of the big organizing principles of Joe Biden's presidency, and a contrast to Donald Trump that maybe doesn't get enough press, because how Trump was realigning foreign policy, it looked to me like instead of allying with all the democracies of the world, as complex as that even is, he was allying with all the authoritarians of the world because they were propping each other up, him and Putin and Bolsonaro and Duterte and Orban and, you know, go down the list, even though most of those I just mentioned are being included in the summit of democracies. And Biden is trying to save the world from this creeping authoritarianism, like you say, in country after country, and how it might even now spill over into us with the canceling of elections that a lot of Republicans want to do and things like that. But can we accomplish that through foreign policy?
You know, that is a great, and it's sort of the key question right now, Brian. Otherwise, I would say America's allies and its adversaries see the United States not doing anything of the kind right now. What they see is a superpower in, if not retreat, at least retrenchment. They see a superpower whose relative muscle in the world and desire to engage with the world has been severely constrained, not least by our own internal fights and divisions with each other of the kind that you just alluded to. The summit for democracies is a great example of that. It's a kind of rhetoric that plays well, certainly, with the Democratic Party sort of activist base. But at the same time, there's this big question, first of all, about our ability. How can we play a leadership role in the world when we're so internally divided and dysfunctional and sclerotic in our own democracy? What kind of a model of democracy are we showing to the rest of the world when you see what's happening here inside the United States? So that's a big problem. Another problem, of course, is the one that Biden's aides knew and sort of dreaded from the minute that this idea was proposed back during the campaign, that they would be sort of clobbered with, like, who's on the invite list and who's not on the invite list. They tried to have to deal with this by a sort of clever sleight of hand and changing the name of it from the Summit of Democracies to the Summit for Democracy. Oh, so it's more aspirational. But of course, who's paying attention to that level of nuance? And, you know, why is Pakistan invited, but NATO and EU member like Hungary is not? Why is Turkey on the list, another important potential ally is not? And so you have this sort of kind of silly distraction that they feared all along. Also, it's taking place virtually because of the pandemic. And there's a real question as to, is this just sort of more talking, another top shop in a world that really doesn't need more yak, but it needs more action. And in that too, there's this sort of eerie and uncomfortable echo of the 1930s and the question of what do you do when faced with outrageous disruptions or potential disruptions of the international order. I read a great, bit of, vicious doggerel from Britain in the 1930s, mocking their politicians for talking and writing up position papers when Italy under Mussolini was preparing to invade Ethiopia, which, by the way, is exactly what Italy did. And so, there's just this big question right now about America's appetite or ability to lead in the world.
Afghanistan. I've been reading about almost half the country being at risk of starvation now that the U.S. has suspended humanitarian aid because of Taliban rule. So how much of a moral dilemma is that for the Biden administration right now? They don't want to prop up the Taliban, but if this mass starvation event is really as bad as is being reported or threatened, oh, my God.
Oh, that's right. I mean, it's horrible for anyone who has ever paid the slightest attention to Afghanistan. You know, when I was there, I covered the initial U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan back in 2001 and 2002. This is like watching a car crash that was predicted unfold. And, seeing this sort of tragedy play out, unfortunately, in just the way that those who had been paying close attention feared and anticipated. And by the way, to the point about democracy and human rights, this is a painful test of the Biden administration, and it's one that it's almost inconceivable that they will pass. The bottom line is that, during the Afghanistan withdrawal over the summer in August, President Biden said, Tony Blinken, his Secretary of State, said, notwithstanding what's happening in Afghanistan, democracy and human rights will remain the foundation of American foreign policy. It's hard to see how, if human rights is a foundation of American foreign policy, that we wouldn't be doing very different things than we are, in fact, doing or plan to do in Afghanistan right now.
Well, what could those things be? Because I think the dilemma that multiple presidents got hung up on in that 20-year war was that even aside from the national security concerns for the United States, was if women were going to be so oppressed by Taliban rule, if democracy for others as well was, going to be so diminished or abolished, but the alternative was the U.S.-supported corrupt government that was over there, you know, when we were supporting them. And Americans don't see the national security interest anymore. It's not the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden era anymore. So why continue to spill American blood over there? But if we're not engaged over there, things like what's happening because the Taliban rule is so terrible that it even contributes to starvation as the economy collapses. I mean, is there any right answer?
Well, look, this is why it's a terrible foreign policy dilemma. But the Biden administration understood privately, certainly very clearly, what the consequences might be, including exactly this scenario when they left. There was a certain amount of public, blabbing about the new kinder, gentler Taliban. That was always bogus. That was never going to be the case. And I think it was a clear-eyed decision. Again, you can argue, and many people believe it's a justifiable decision for all the reasons that you just laid out, Brian, that the United States would no longer continue to be there. But this is the consequence. And Americans just aren't very good at accepting that there might be a cost and it might, be uncomfortable for them in a moral sense to confront the cost of their choices. We've made choices in Afghanistan, and they have come with costs, including a cost in human lives as well.
I guess that the debate at the end of the day in Afghanistan was, could we keep a small number of troops there, just a few thousand troops, and that would deter the Taliban enough that the nominal Afghanistan government could remain intact and things wouldn't get this bad? Or, as I think Biden argued and Blinken argued, if we tried to do that, the Taliban would just up its military offensive against the Americans, draw a lot of American blood, and then force this decision anyway, bigger war or go home. Was that?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair outlining.
Do you agree? I mean, was Biden, in your opinion, as a foreign affairs expert, did Biden get that right, that's what would have happened, that we'd now be having a conversation about war and American bloodshed in Afghanistan if we weren't having this conversation?
Well, I think you've outlined very fairly, what the sort of divide was, what the choice was for Biden. In the end, it's a choice with a series of, unknowable outcomes. But what strikes me is that it's quite predictable what's playing out now as a consequence of that choice in terms of potential famine and human catastrophe inside Afghanistan, Taliban not keeping their word, not allowing girls to go to school, not allowing women's rights, constraining and constricting the society in dramatic and really radical ways. And so no one can be surprised that that's the consequence of that decision.
Last thing, because we only invited you on to talk about hard things. We'll have to do another segment where you talk about easier things. China. There are new fears of China invading Taiwan. I don't know if it's really going to happen, but at the same time that everybody's worried about Russia invading Ukraine, people are worried about China invading Taiwan, which China still claims should be part of it. And there's the U.S. diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in China because of the imprisonment of Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai after she accused a government official of sexual assault. But we're still sending our athletes. So are we looking the other way, in effect, at this mix of authoritarianism and misogyny?
Well, I think that, it's a significant step. It's the first time since, Jimmy Carter in the 1980 Olympics announced a boycott. Now, he went for a full boycott. Most people think, Democrats and Republicans, that was sort of a disaster and did not really work out successfully for Carter. So this is a different, sort of more limited option. You see just today, I believe, the British joining in with a diplomatic boycott as well as the United States. One thing that's very important and that is a big difference, I think, in the Biden foreign policy versus certainly the Trump foreign policy is a desire to be much more in sync with the allies, to be both tougher and more confrontational when it comes to Russia and China, but to do so in coordination as much as possible with European allies and Asian allies when it comes to China. And you see that, for example, this week with Biden making a point of calling European leaders before his video conference with Vladimir Putin, and then once again afterwards after he had that call. Same thing on the coordinated rollout of the diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. But, you know, in the maybe it's not going to happen in the very short term, right? It's not like Russia with Ukraine right now and 175,000 troops on the border. But China's made it clear that it's playing a long-term, very clear-cut military game when it comes to Taiwan. And, you know, much more assertive, even changing military doctrine toward Taiwan in the last few years. And so I think, you know, there's a real concern that this might not be a tomorrow problem with Taiwan, but it's one that we can't just ignore, that it really is going to be a confrontation, at least in the medium term.
Susan Glasser, who reports from Washington for The New Yorker, is a CNN global affairs analyst and co-author of The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of Jim Baker. Susan, so interesting and incisive as always. And again, you stepped up at the very last minute when Senator Murphy had to cancel. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for being with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.